versions, and the results seem to support that. This jagged, the reason that this is jagged is because the mask moves around, okay? And we force the mask to be in a grid point, so it moves discontinuously. So when we do all the averaging for convergent, you have that there are points that are closer or further to the singularity, and that's why it spoils a little bit that thing. But it's still, the amplitude is not that bad.
Is this subconvergent or convergence to the known solution?
This is convergence to the known solution. Because again, this runs doing true convergence, it would be horrendous to do it for thousands of them. Okay? But it includes several levels of refinement. It's not that it's just one. Okay? I'm plotting because the truncation error should go as discretization scale to the power A. A is exponent, which should be 2. So that's what it is here.
What quantity and what norm?
Oh, this is an L2 norm.
Oh,
okay. So yeah. So it's of the trace of the extrinsic curvature or the conformal factor. I don't remember which of the two, but that's a good point.
A
is just the exponent. But then we check the apparent horizon area. And now let me talk about how we follow this. We don't use apparent horizon trackers because it's too expensive, and we don't take advantage that we know the solution. So Uli designed a scheme that is based on how astronomers fit spectral lines with Gaussians, right? So he designed a scheme that he said, look, for this case, we can just treat this as a line profile and fit to the Gaussian and just follow that. So there is this thing here is just fitting Gaussians, and that's how we move the mask. There is no, we don't use any information about the solution. We just fit Gaussians. Gaussian profiles. All right. Now, as Jeff has mentioned, how about boundary effects? The runs that I show you, this is the Guinness run, okay? We only plotted to 2,000, but it went to 6,000. It's just that. And it's 20 by 20 by 7. We use equatorial symmetry also to make it. Now, if we increase the dimension orthogonal to the orbital plane, the run also, this is as today. These runs take too long. So right now we're at 1,000. If we increase also the dimensions on the plane, it stays fine here, but you see here that there is indication that it's going to blow up, which is clear here. Let me tell you the difference between these two plots. This is just the L2 norm of the Hamiltonian constraint. This is the normalized. So here, what is going wrong is in the boundary conditions outside, not in the excision. Why do we know that? Because a normalized Hamiltonian constraint will bias information from the outer boundary because you are dividing by small terms. The normalized Hamiltonian constraint, just for those who don't know, you get the Hamiltonian and you divide by the sum of the absolute values of the terms that construct the Hamiltonian. So if those things are small, it will emphasize things in the boundary. And that's why in the plots, in the movies, we always plot the normalized to emphasize that that's where we have our problem, in the outer boundary. And this one crashes. But it's still at 1,000, which it seems to me that is good news. All right, now head-on collisions.
Sorry, you showed secondary convergence in the previous one that some of your deployments, if you had more resolution, they would crash. These are different boundary locations?
These are different boundary locations with the same resolution.
20 by 20 by 7, that's the size of the domain?
Yeah, 20 by 20 by 7. The active size of the domain, the one that actually do the calculation. Okay? Now,
so the run track is only
at the boundary spread out. Yeah, which is what we usually observe when you have, that's what I was saying, the sweet spot. If you put the boundary around 10m or less, I mean, things are very, very nice. The larger you make your box, things go wacko.
It's obvious with constant resolution, right?
Yeah. No, this is just the experiment is just to demonstrate boundary effects. Yeah. The convergence, we keep the boundaries fixed and did convergence. Because we wanted to do one or the other. All right. So now head-on collisions. And the reason for doing this is not because it hasn't been done before. It's because it hasn't been done with excision. Okay. The postdoc, they did punctures first, and then they excised because they cannot move their excision region. And then now what we want to do is with excision. But this is very, very preliminary, and you can see why. So he collides, and that you see here all the problems in outer boundary. But then something, Bernard Kelly is the one mostly in charge of that, something happened. The black hole moves, well, it's going south. The black hole was sitting here, and then it decides, so this is a black hole with an attitude, to move to the right. You will see that. Look at it. You see, it moves to the right. So something, and I knew about this last week, and he has been working. He said, Pablo, I cannot find it, so I just have to show you what we have. I'm sorry? Sorry, Bob. Yeah, all right. Okay, so now, how about orbits? Okay, this is done with the other code, not with my. And here, what we are doing, so it's with this modified BSSN. The initial data is this superimposed Ingo and Eddington Finkelstein. Now, we don't have elliptic solvers to get honest initial data, so we go through some approximations, so the initial data is not exact, but so what? Our simulations still crash, so I don't think it's the initial data, it's something else. Gauge conditions, we're using this 1 plus log and gamma driver, and the 1 plus log is the densitized, but it's, so it's just a generalization. And outer boundary, we try to be a little bit more honest and do something that lets the waves out. So here is our, and this is in a co-rotating type of frame. Still, the data is not completely co-rotating. I don't know if you have seen, I mean, it's very short-lived. You see that it only lives for around 10 m or something like that. And the black holes are approaching, and there is something obviously going wrong. But the point is just a proof of principle that I think that if we start, you know, polishing all the things, that eventually we're going to make things going beyond the 10% of an orbit that is claiming that thing. So hopefully this next time that we show this will be a little bit longer. And here is just a slide showing, you're saying what I mentioned before. We track the 1/r falloff near the singularity and fit a Gaussian to that, even in this case that it has some distortions. If you don't get the distortions to be too large, it is a quick way of tracking where you need to excise. It's not tracking the singularity, but making an educated guess on where to get rid of the singularity. All right. The other piece of work that we have been working now for the last 6 months or so deals with this. It always bothers me to think that the class of solutions of just the evolution equations of the Einstein evolution equations, given a formulation, that it would be all of them just exponentially growing. And I said there must be some solutions in which they violate the constraints, but they stay put. I mean, by put, they're bound not by an exponential, for something less than that. So the thing that we decided to do was to say, well, suppose that we get the solution for Ingo and Eddington Finkelstein, and we distort it. How do we distort it? Well, let's distort it with something like this, in which the trace of the extrinsic curvature is this plus some function that takes you off the constraint surface. The same thing for the conformal factor. We put some wild lambs to make it interesting, and some radial function that basically is a Gaussian. Not basically, it is a Gaussian. So that's one way. So what happened is you put your black hole with the Eddington Finkelstein solution, and then you distort it, the space-time outside, and that solution is not a solution to the Einstein equation. You can also do other thing. I say you start with a black hole with mass m, and you decide, just because you want to have fun, change the boundary in such a way that asymptotically is the solution of a black hole with different mass. That's not a solution to the Einstein. So we did also with the mass parameter that is one in the interior, and it just has some, goes from one mass to another.
This is for the initial data.
That's for initial data, okay? And this is what happens, okay? So this is just a distortion. Here is the excision region. Here, the red thing is things inside the apparent horizon. For this one, we actually go and look for apparent horizons. And here is your distortion. It's an L equal 2M equals 0 thing. And here is the same distortion, but now this space, part of the space, assumes a different mass from the one here, okay? But still, if you calculate the apparent horizon, both of them are the same because you have done things outside. All right. Now this, it's off shell, right? It should blow up, okay? And there it goes. So notice here that how, I think I even, no, these pictures are reverse. The one distortion with the plane is this, because that is, it has a stronger junk, and eventually the apparent horizon, you know, this is growing like that. But the bottom line is that they are stable. Okay, how do I know that? Here is again the time derivative of the, and it just keeps going down. Okay, here again we didn't want to go too far in that, but both solutions seem to be relaxing. It seems that the excision region thinks, I mean the excision boundary is such that junk gets, and we had the wrong boundary condition. There is no radiative thing. We actually had the analytic solution, so things should be just, that's why we call it black hole in a box. Okay. Now, yeah, this is fine, but then what kind of space-time we have now that we, well, how can, so what we did is we calculated the Weyl invariant, and I'm just showing here I and J, and just for reference, this is for a black hole, okay? So you can see that the one in which we have a distortion, we get high discrepancies at the beginning, but eventually it settles down to satisfy this condition. Now, that doesn't guarantee that it's a black hole, because that's all, there are other space-times that satisfy this, but I mean, you know, that's a black hole satisfied. But this is the other one in which we put the mass, different mass aside from the one inside, and you can have orders of magnitude discrepancy, but it still eventually settles down. So now,
where do you calculate the invariance? Where in space?
Oh, okay. What we do is we multiply by R cubed. And actually, that's a good point. We multiply by R cubed just to get off of this here. And then in this case, we do an L2 norm everywhere. Okay. But that's the problem, actually. That is the key point. Because even if you calculate that invariant, to compare with another space-time, you have to define where you identify the coordinate point. So I'm not claiming anything about it. I'm just telling you that it's stable. I'm not saying that anything. Now, and also, not all the equations can handle this. With this system of equations, if we were to change the exponents in certain ways or use something else, the simulation is unstable. So obviously, it depends on the evolution equations, because it depends on how these things are propagated. All right. So,
what do the constraints do?
I'm sorry?
What do the constraints do?
Oh, it's settled down.
To a
non-zero value. Yeah. Okay, and of course the blend, this one, because we didn't put such a high junk, it settles down to a smaller value, but it's comparing to zero, so I don't know what to compare with the Hamiltonian. That's why we're trying to focus on this invariant, because we thought that the Hamiltonian in that case, through convergence, we can see if it settles down to a given value, so that could also give us information.
Can we check convergence?
Yeah.
Can we also move the boundary out?
But this, yeah, but not too far out. Okay, but that's not the point. The point here is that I wanted to show that through convergence, because the boundary is the wrong boundary there. I just wanted to show a simple example in which you can have evolution which you are completely off the constraint, and it could be in the through convergence, it could be stable. So that was the only exercise. All right, so I'm more positive than I was when last time I gave a talk on this thing. I think excision seemed to be in a good track. This, I think, is encouraging, although it needs to figure out how generic they are, how to depend on the evolution equations, or there's more work needed in that. Then we need to improve engage and boundary, outer boundary conditions, because when we start, the reason that we can move the black hole for thousands on M and not the two black holes is, of course, we're still taking advantage that we know too much about the solution for the single black hole. But the binary, you had to work a little harder. A lot harder. So more creative engineering is needed. And I promise Byrne that I wasn't going to use the word dirty numerics or filthy numerics, but creative engineering. So there it is. It's up to you to define what you believe. You can go a little bit more into the formal side or, you know. The other thing, what happened here? Okay, there. And one thing that I'm trying to make a case is that we should not be afraid of using this symbol, okay, in, when you're trying to do work, or if you want to be a little bit more brave, even that. Or you can even do this, okay? I actually published a paper with Martin Rees, and he only puts those wiggle things, and it was a serious paper, right? So approximations are not bad. That's the bottom line. Okay, now, one thing that I want to finish with is just to give you, what is, now that the movie The Terminator is coming tomorrow, I'm going to give you the sneak preview of something that I just recently started. Okay, it started yesterday. Oh, okay. All right, so this is the, actually I forgot to acknowledge Kip. I found this in the webpage. Who's supposed to be the one who is supposed to acknowledge the, anyway. We have that the strict mass ratio binaries are one of the important sources for LISA, okay? And one of them is, as is stated in the review by Kip and others, is it will provide a map of the black hole space-time. And also, if you want to solve this, you need to deal with radiation reaction problem. Given the scales that you have here, in principle, 11 orders of magnitude, this will be a beautiful problem to do numerical with the appropriate adaptive mesh refinement. And there have been some attempts on doing that. Jeff and collaborators and Luis have done something. Jorge with a former student of Penn State, Ramon Lopez and Gaurav Khanna have tried to do that. So there have been attempts to do that. So I am currently trying to put the numerics on this problem, but in a little different way. So I'm going to just give you a little bit of what we have done. This is a toy model. It's supposed to capture the main difficulties in the problem. What are the main difficulties is you need to do numerics in the small object. Here is a black hole, and you should be able to resolve things here, the waves, things around the black hole, and the outer boundary. Now, notice that you don't recognize my collaborators, and they're in the math department, and I have problems communicating the scale, what do you mean to do everything in M, even time in M and so on. So we didn't understand each other about the separation. So here is a black hole, and it's completely resolved. It's 2m. And he thought that I was saying, put the orbit at 70m, and I meant 7m. So he put it at 70m, and I came back to it. I said, okay, fine. And the outer boundary is at 200, but he can put it for that. And so here is, it's a toy model. It's 2D. There is no claim of physics here, as we have here. It's just a toy model, and there it goes. It will go for an orbit and a half, but it's the movie. The animated GIF is too large, so I will not show it all. And also the initial conditions are wrong, of course.
What are you showing here?
Here I'm showing the field variable. This is basically a modified wave equation. So I'm just showing, there is only one field that we saw, but we just wanted to demonstrate that the technology is at reach to do this problem. Yeah, that's what I'm going to go after.
And it's a fixed background?
It's a fixed background. So there is a mesh and there is a refinement. Okay? Right. So, I usually, that's okay. Okay. Right. Right. I'm not known to sell things too strongly, but I think it's about time maybe because I'm getting at the right age bracket in which I can tell you that it's really exciting.
So it's a wave equation 2+1?
2+1.
The source is sort of some smooth source.
Yeah.
What's the exciting part
is that this, from the computational point of view, is that This is work in less than 2 months and all that, and I've been always trying to get adaptive mesh refinement and things to be able to resolve the scales. You can, the other movie, you can see things.
People who are not doing well, I mean, you emphasize again scales, right? The ratio of the black hole mass, the central object mass, and the other mass is the mass.
You mentioned it's a 10-pound from the general, relatively equal mass black
hole. Oh, yeah, yeah, no, this is okay. From the point of view of resolving scales, this is more difficult than the binary equal mass black hole. But of course, in the equal mass, you have to solve the whole enchilada, all the Einstein equations. Here, we're just doing a reduced set of it. Yeah?
So would it be computationally feasible eventually to do like 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 orbit?
10 to the 5, that I doubt it. I doubt it. But what we can do is to take it beyond what Scott Hughes has taken it. Okay, and hopefully it will be the last day, which is the last day of the plunge, which we're talking about 400 orbits or something. So our goal is to go in that regime and see, because you cannot see here, but the waves actually sink through that thing and there is no problem there.
Oh, so you're interested in the kind of plunge.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, no, still you have to, the long time integration.
And you can also use it to provide error bars to the relationship reaction.
All right. Thank you.
Questions?
So when you showed your binary, your macro binary?
Yes.
That was in a co-rotating frame?
Yes.
So given that they didn't move very far at all in this frame, that means that apparently you got the augur velocity quite right.
Yeah.
So how do you determine the augur velocity?
We don't solve the constraints. It's a minimization procedure.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's a minimization procedure that it boils down to construct a function that depends on the Hamiltonian, the momentum constraint, and other quantities in which we just do a parameter search for which that function has a minimum. That's the, of course, if we really had that solution, it would be zero, but we're just happy with the minimum. And that's because, that's what I mean by creative engineering. If you don't have something, you just try to get around it. And that's how we got around it.
So just trying to understand the implication of what, when you were talking about the constraint violating model. So is the idea that usually if you have something which is violating the constraints, everything blows up very quickly, exponentially? Not that you're supposedly wanting to have solutions that violate the constraints, but you just want to know if that's always a correlation?
I wanted to know if the space of solution of the evolution equations for a given system, all of them imply that you have an exponential growth.
If you're violating
right, off the constraint surface, and that.
Yeah, but numerical simulations, you'll always want a constraint a little bit. Then if you're off shell, then you go off completely, very quickly, and that is unstable. That doesn't know what.
Right, that's so precise.
That's why this is the best bet to see that, does that always happen?
Yeah, and maybe we were just lucky. Maybe the space of solutions is very small, we were just lucky.
It's very special.
Yes, and yeah, but you know, of course, that if you violate the constraint, that if you don't violate the constraint, you're going to be stable.
Right, right. So it's an
experience from you.
You say something more about what you plan to do about battery additions because at the outer battery, I thought you're concerned with. I mean,
well, if
trying to enforce constraints at the battery.
Well, that will be the correct way of doing things, but sometimes the equations that we get from the people who derive those are, we'll have to spend a lot of time to implement them, and we have to keep moving. I mean, that's the thing. If you push the boundaries a little further out, then you can approximate it to flat space plus perturbations, and then you make an educated guess about how the modes propagate out, and do those simple outgoing Sommerfeld type conditions. And if they work to the level that allows you to do the physics within the thousands of them, then that's fine. Eventually, you should move on to the perfect boundary absorbing and constraint satisfying and all of that. I'm not opposed to that. It's just that you have to pick your battles. But now it's clear that our next step is we need to improve the outer boundaries, because you saw that that's what, there is strong indication that that's where we're having a problem.
In your natural choice for the parameters, in particular n equal minus
1.
If you set it so that that coefficient is negative rather than just 0, do you get any
gain? Yeah, actually the funny thing, and I was, we're having dinner, yes, if you look at Ingoing and Eddington Finkelstein solution, the lapse is proportional to 1 over the square root of g, okay? So if you send this to this is not densitized, this is the true lap. So if you send this to this guy here, and then you call it this, your densitized lapse, it has the opposite exponent. It should be minus 1, not plus 1, okay? If you put that in your code, it blows up immediately, even that is consistent with the analytic solution. Okay, that one I don't know. Maybe some people doing perturbation to figure that out.
And I have another question about your exposition. What exactly are you doing? I mean, you said there are a number of options.
We're doing both. We're doing the one in we extrapolate the right-hand side, or we extrapolate the solution. And we have found, at least for this test, that it doesn't make tremendous difference. Okay, it actually works a little better in some cases, the extrapolated solution.
What order of direction is it?
Okay, the order is important. If you go too high, as it was, then you don't go anywhere. You cannot go to zero order. You cannot just go to simple copying as Alcubierre and Brugmann did, because the solution is time dependent. Then that translates to imposing a boundary condition. So you cannot, you can go, it's fine to do, you know. Right. So it's consistent with that.
So what linear order?
We use linear, but I think, if I remember correctly, second order. It depends on what you're talking about. It depends if it's in the solution or in the right-hand side.
Third order solution extrapolation,
yeah.
Linear, along a line that is not, so if you were in a spherical grid, you could do a radial line, but we're in a Cartesian grid. Yeah. So we choose a line that actually has the grid points on it, so we don't have to control it. Do you have a picture
of it?
No, you
can tell
me. Not
my
talk, okay.
Yeah. It's okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you again.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
So you never explained P code.
The P code of what?
Huh?
Which P?
What does P stand for?
Ah, puta. Prostitute.
The thing is, you really do see these unbounded things.
My experience with these outer boundary conditions and other problems is that just constant extrapolation often works more stably than trying to do a linear extrapolation.
Okay.
Higher order extrapolation, at least with these,
but
with
so,
these finite volume methods.
So I mean, if you have your PDE, I mean, something like this, when you say constant, is constant extrapolation of this guy or of this guy to be, or both? Or
of the solution, but we're using these finite volume methods where, and rather than having some point-wise values, we have values that are cell averages,
right,
over a grid cell. So if you have a boundary, say this is your computational boundary,
yeah, and what, I
what we do is to extend the solution to some ghost cells out here.
Okay.
And just by copying this value over here,
oh,
at the beginning of the time step. And now, since we're solving a Riemann problem between the
okay,
each step, when you solve a Riemann problem between two constant values, you get zero strength waves, and in particular, no incoming waves.
Oh.
And so even if there should be outgoing information, you're not capturing that properly, but you're not using, you don't need to update the ghost cell value, because the next time step, you're going to copy that over again anyway.
Oh,
and so
okay,
what you really care about is not having any incoming
information.
And by doing it and then solving the Riemann problem, you're sort of ensuring that you don't have any incoming information.
correct?
And if you try to do it better by sort of doing a linear extrapolation or something, I found that almost always ends up being unstable. Whereas just doing this constant extrapolation. It's not perfect because if you have something that should be going out to the angle, there really should be some sort of incoming information that cancels out. But usually if it's going fairly normal to the boundary, it works very well.
Yeah.
And even at angles, if you sort of are approaching, say, a corner, sometimes you get a bit of reflection there, but it still seems to stay very stable. And it gives much less reflection than if I had
If we would...
There's probably something in the equations that have secondary, but...
Yeah, it's a mess here.
Yeah, if you have second derivatives coming in, it's really near everything is first order.
And even if it's first order, I don't think we can put it in the conservative form that you take advantage of all.
It doesn't necessarily have to be conservative.
It doesn't have to be?
Okay. If it's hyperbolic and you have a way of sort of decomposing a jump in two states into waves going,
okay.
You know, what speed the
well,
waves
maybe,
are going.
Maybe even if it, even if one solves second order, but then at the boundary, then go and solve this the reduced problem as first order. You can introduce this. Like, maybe that can. I'll take a look at it because it would be nice to not having to go into very sophisticated outer boundaries. I mean,
in fact, we're trying that even if you have some incoming and some outgoing information. Because of the fact that you're solving this Riemann problem here, which is sort of splitting things up into characteristic directions and only putting the incoming part in, you can be pretty lax about, you don't have to be careful about specifying exactly the right number of boundary conditions because that's handled automatically. And so, for example, if you know you have an exact solution you're trying to match, you can just put that exact solution in the ghost cells, and it'll take kind of the incoming part of that. When you solve the Riemann problem, you're automatically getting kind of the incoming part of that, and the outgoing part only would affect the ghost cells, but you're not using that because you're rewriting those ghost cells the next time.
Oh, that's good to know.
For example, we've looked at problems for you. Like just as a test problem, we have a plane wave we were looking at some problems for range acoustics. We had a plane wave hitting an interface between different materials, and we wanted to look at how it was reflecting and so on. So as this is propagating along, we have to have this the right boundary conditions
for this
plane wave coming in, and then later on there'll be reflected wave here and a transmitted wave. But for a simple problem, you can figure out what the analytic solution is, and just by putting that in the ghost cells, it works fine, and you don't get any sort of spurious junk.
Good.
At least it's much smaller than what you care about.
That's good to know.
From the boundaries.
But this conversation
kind of works surprisingly well. It's so simple.
The
fact that you're doing the Riemann solution helps because it's selecting
the right. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's.
If you don't have a way of sort of doing a Riemann solver,
then
what you're looking at may not help.
Thank you for
this last problem that you showed that was.
Yeah.
That was on a fixed metric?
Yeah.
What were the equations that you were solving?
It's just a wave equation.
The wave equation?
Yeah.
Does that look like an interesting problem that you try with?
Yeah.
We're trying to use adaptive metric finding.
It's just this with a source that is localized. But I just wanted to test the infrastructure. And that's it.
Was that basically the same as the acoustics equations that I was?
Probably. Yeah.
So it should be, you just have a source that should just spread out.
It spreads out, but I move the source around.
Oh, so you move the source around.
Right. And actually, one of the things you can do, you pre-specify the source so you can have the right frequency to populate the domain with all that. And the idea is just to show that I have the thing in place. Well, look, I
this was Jin Chao
Chu. Jin Chao Chu, and I gave up with finite differences to do this problem because I don't have AMR. So I've been looking around spectral methods. I thought that it was too convoluted for me, and that's when I bought your book and said, "Look, let's see." And I said, "Well, no, and I don't have an expert here." So I went across the street, and Jin Chao said, "Yes, we can do it." So I mean, you know him, right? He always says that yes, but it's not quite. So I've been very, very. I mean, Peng Tao Son is the postdoc who's actually there. I was amazed. I mean, I'm not saying that this is the only way, but I mean, it's nice to see that something.
You have a code that does
that. Yeah. And because you know how it came up? It came up that we were going to solve we're going to solve elliptic equations for initial data, And then he said, look, let me show you what we can do. And they have this problem of a fluid with a cylinder in the middle that heats up, so it creates turbulence. And he showed me the AMR. I said, look, man, I have another problem that is a lot simpler than that, and let's try it. And that's how it came up. I think, I don't know the details yet of the code that they are using, but I think there are some components from a code, finite element codes in Germany. I don't remember which one is. That's the thing that he told me, but I'll know more later. All right. Yeah. No, I'm we're in the process of that's why I say sneak preview. I mean, everything is still, but now the thing is that you can address all these large scales that we were after, you know. Of course, this one is not that as extreme. It's not 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus, well, no, this is only 4 orders of magnitude that we're looking. But 4 orders of magnitude is pretty good for what I used to doing when two black holes are the same mass. I mean, we usually can only handle two orders of magnitude, but it was...
Well, I'll try something.
All right.